Welcome to another episode of the Pixel Drone Show, the podcast where we talk to industry professionals about how they use drones in their space. Your hosts for today are Kara Murphy, Greg Riverio, and myself, Haya Kestelo. And if you're new to the Pixel Drone Show, please be sure to subscribe. We have a new episode every Tuesday, and the more people subscribe and like our show, the faster we'll grow and the more interesting guests we can interview. That brings us to today's guests. We have Dave Messina and Josh Cook on the show for today. They are both members of the FPV Freedom Coalition. Dave is the president and CEO. Josh is the vice president. They both have quite some experience flying drones and flying RC aircraft, so we'll definitely be sure to talk about that as well. Let's just jump right into it, I guess. Dave and Josh, can you tell us, we'll start with you, Josh, by the way. Can you tell us something about your background and how you got into flying FPV drones?
Absolutely. So I started flying FPV. I actually saw a video from one of my old professors at University of Arizona, and he had posted a clip from DRL when they were first doing the test runs through Miami Dolphin Stadium. And that really inspired me to fly drones. When I was a kid, I wanted to be a helicopter pilot. And due to my eyesight and stuff like that, it became a little more difficult. So I kind of set that dream aside. And as soon as I saw what they were doing with drones, I had to be a part of it. So I got myself a little Hubson, I think off Amazon, and I started teaching myself how to fly. And then I picked up a ZMR 250 and taught myself how to solder, put it together, and it just kind of exploded from there. And I fly mostly freestyle quads. I've delved into FPV wings a little bit, that kind of stuff, but I am mostly exclusively a quad flyer. So I don't race. I don't think I have the reflexes for it, but I do love I do try and do high speed freestyle. So anything that I can do where I'm going fast and pulling great tricks is a lot of fun. So awesome. Been doing it for probably about 5-6 years now.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I was going to say quick reflexes is definitely something you need. So my first time flying FPV was with the DJI drone, and I got some close calls there as well initially. Dave, can you tell us about your days with RC aircraft and then later on with drones as well?
Sure. I've been flying model airplanes. I looked at the calendar and it's for a little over 55 years. So I've been building and designing models for a long time. It's one of the things that inspired me to go into mechanical engineering. After college, flying RC and flying and teaching my son in Austin, Texas, and then getting involved in national events. So I've been pretty avid as a sport flyer in model airplanes in the 60 to 80 inch wingspan category, all line of sight. From there, I got into a trio of us were building foam airplanes that flew at 100 miles an hour, much like a flight test plane, but they also flew very slowly, very well. And from there, I saw some first-person view RC planes, and I just had to try that. And that got me involved in FPV. That was about early 2016, and then I've just been building, and I'm a shade tree mechanic and working on cars and motorcycles, so building and soldering has been pretty natural. So got into that. Like Josh, I fly freestyle, and my reflex time is nowhere near what the young kids are with the racing. But I am interested in setting up a track in my yard and seeing if I can at least get something approaching a multiple of what the young guys are flying on multi-GP.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you for sharing that. Greg, I think we're going over to you for the first question.
Yeah, I've got the tough questions for you, Dave. No, just kidding. Dave, I know you're involved with the DAC, and we kind of talked a little bit about this. The Drone Advisory Committee, sorry for those of you that are listening. I want to backtrack a little bit and talk about how you guys decided to start the FPV Freedom Coalition. What was the idea and what is the goal of the organization for those that are not familiar with it?
And I welcome Josh to chime in on this as well. We felt that there was not a lot of energy going into fighting for the rights of FPV flyers and recreational flyers in general. There are 1.2 million recreational drone operators in the United States today. That's anywhere from 5 to 7 times as many commercial Part 107 pilots. And so there's just not an organization around. And we felt that the AMA, while that's part of their scope, is to fight for the rights to fly and to advocate to the FAA, that their focus, at least at the individual fields, was primarily line of sight, fixed wing, traditional radio control model airplanes. So we started that work. I joined just as a group was forming in late 2018. And we felt that our goal should be educating people on safety aspects of UAS, small UAS or drones, as well as promoting FPV, as well as advocating and educating the FAA for better regulations and our ability to continue to fly. Josh, want to amplify any of those points?
Absolutely. So the inciting incident that kind of sparked our formation was the Reauthorization Act of 2018. And that's when they decided to do away with Section 336. And we started seeing remote ID idea pop up. And we were pretty concerned about our ability to advocate for ourselves. And it didn't seem like, as Dave was saying, that we were getting much representation for multi-rotors in general. So that's when we kind of came together and started pushing down this path that would allow us to kind of insert ourselves into the process. And we're taking a position of working with the FAA to improve things from within as opposed to being combative. And we've seen some excellent results from that. And I think that as we continue down this path, those results will become more and more evident. So,
yeah, and I think that's important. You guys have the right approach. It's difficult enough to work with the FAA, but doing it in a non-combative and trying to make things work for everyone is definitely the way to go. So, and Haya, I think you had a follow-up.
Yeah, I was wondering, I mean, it says FPV Freedom Coalition. Are you guys purely focused on quadcopters or is it pretty much any kind of drone? And if so, how can people contribute and help you guys achieve your goals?
So absolutely not. While we are primarily focused on FPV, we are open to everybody. We don't exclude anybody. We understand that people from all walks of model aviation, whether it be fixed wing or quadcopter or heli or anything, they're all affected by these regulations. And I think by advocating for the new kid on the block, which is going to be FPV, we are in turn advocating for a lot of the other aspects of model aviation as well. So, and in terms of how to support us, you can go to our website, fpvfc.org. There are donate buttons on there, or you can become a member. And it's an annual membership. And that just helps support everything we do in terms of getting us out, traveling to events and whatnot. Dave often has to, well, before the pandemic, he was going to DC quite a bit for DAC meetings, and hopefully that'll pick back up here soon. I was able to go to DC for the protests, and as well as one of our other officers was able to go to Rampage and do some advocating for us there as well. So getting out to events, getting the word out, that kind of stuff, that really helps us out. None of us have taken a salary. Everything is volunteer. So everything goes towards either our actual incidentals, which would be our technology, our website, our server, you know, that kind of stuff, or getting out and advocating for the hobby.
And I would build on that, that in addition to recreational, there's a lot of crossover to commercial. And so we work with and talk to a lot of Part 107, the work we do with Greg. I'm an advisory board member of the Drone Service Provider Alliance. And so we are absolutely encouraging people all the time. If you're into recreational, if you're young, and this could be a career, or if it's something a gateway to something else, go for your Part 107. We know of a great place to get education with Pilot Institute. We recommend people go to Pilot Institute website for the trust for the recreational test. So, yeah, we are. Their logo is quads. It is FPV. We show a little wing on the quad, but we have and our mission. That is the mission and our responsibility as a 501c3. However, a lot of the work that we've done with the FAA on DAX absolutely covers, gets into commercial, as well as the work we've done with ASTM, as well as the Beyond Visual Line of Sight ARC.
So you've worked with the FAA on various committees. What was it like working on the Drone Advisory Committee with Vic Moss, of all people? He was one of our first guests. And how did you get into DAC to begin with?
Okay, so we are not a member of the Drone Advisory Committee yet. I have, and so in order to, you have to apply, and then mm-hmm. you're selected. And so I have applied once, and then renewed that again. So we'll see. Hopefully, I can join as a member in order to. Work on a tasking group. The way that the whole body operates is that the FAA puts out an assignment, and we work on that. A group works on that task, and once you hear about the identification of that task, you raise your hand, volunteer, and there has to be a split of about 50% DAC members and 50% other. And so I've been lucky to get into the 50% other category on. 9 tasking groups: remote ID, UAS facility map, spectrum, C2, UTM, safety culture, utilizing remote ID information to improve situational awareness, gender-neutral language recommendation for the FAA, and currently working on a safety foundation, as well as how to institute aviation-specific STEM into K-12 in the United States. So the way that it works is that I was thinking about it before we came on, and it's there's an analogy of a term paper, but it's a term paper with a group. And so if you're given an assignment by a teacher, you have to think about the scope, you have to do research, you have to come up with a hypothesis, you have to write the proposal with lots of citations and references to your research. But the added complexity and fun of it with the DAC is you're doing it with 20 other people, and you're doing it across organizations. And not everyone has the same agenda. In fact, that's rare that you find people with the same agenda. And so the experience that I bring to the table of herding cats in IBM, running projects from hardware, software, services, marketing, mergers and acquisitions over almost 4 decades, as well as writing, presenting, doing narratives, doing presentations, is a skill set that is completely transferable to this type of work. And that's why we've been effective. And that's why I'm really fortunate to have been able to present a couple of times to the FAA and represent the team that we put together in the DAC advisory group. Working with Vic, to come back to that part of your question, Kara, it's always a pleasure. He brings an aw shucks, calls it as he sees it approach. He is always straightforward, and his knowledge and his personal network is fantastic. And so, yeah, it's always fun to work with Vic and to bounce ideas around. And it's been I'm very grateful to be asked to be an advisory board member to DSBA.
Nice.
Yep. I second that. Work with Vic on a regular basis, so he's definitely a knowledgeable person and really good to work with. Yeah. I want to bring the big topic, and it's the remote ID. Let's talk about remote ID and how this is such a hot topic, especially in the FPV community. And I want you to explain, both of you, to explain how this is going to impact operations for FPV pilots, but also for everybody else.
Josh, you want to start?
Absolutely. So remote ID started off as an idea put forward from Congress, and the FAA, through the Reauthorization Act, kind of had to move forward with that. So when they finally came out with the NPRM for remote ID, it was, I think, a little bit late, according to their original schedule, and it was a little bit over the top. And okay, so it was a lot of bit over the top, but so we kind of dug around into the NPRM, and we pulled out the biggest issues. Amongst those were privacy and the ability of drones to connect to a network-based solution, and several other things. And so we put forth a pretty massive document, and we got it out to all the people that we could. And we utilized our kind of contacts that Dave has built up through his work on the DAC tasking groups. And he was able to kind of get some ideas from where they were headed in their responses. So once we put that out, we got it out to the FPV community. We opened up the documents for comments and were able to kind of get everybody's feel on what was going on. And then we kind of finalized that and sent it back to everybody so that they could utilize that. And we, along with several other organizations, including the AMA, put out the call to action on that. And we were able to get 53,000 comments together as a community, not just us, but 53,000 comments to the FAA, which I believe has been the most comments they've ever received on an NPRM, and kind of really put it out there. And so eventually they rolled back out with the final rule, and it appears that they listened, and there were some solutions that really made sense. There were some solutions that we put forward that they took, including the ability for remote ID to be equipped to drones via a broadcast module. So basically being able to take legacy drones and add remote ID to it. So now that impact that it's going to have, especially on the FPV community, is equipping a drone, what the FAA calls an amateur-built drone, with an additional piece of equipment, with an additional radio signal coming off of it, might pose some challenges with either the control signal or with the video signal. We rely heavily with video signals, obviously with FPV. And as well as for racing, it puts additional weight on something that they strive to reduce every gram on these aircraft.
And so I've had the luxury of being able to jot some notes while you're talking, Josh. And so, as you were saying, certainly cost and weight, and we've heard estimates of the broadcast module, 15, 20 grams. So for an FPV rig that's a pound, not too bad. But as Josh said, for racing, this is really bad news. So that type of weight penalty, even though everyone would carry it, that's not a positive. So from an equipage perspective, weight on the aircraft is an issue. From a process and other issue and legal perspective, we're really still upset about the fact that the remote ID will publish or broadcast the location of the operator in addition to the location of the aircraft. And we know that, Greg, you're not happy about that as well. And yep. So the location of the operator is the initial control for a hobby built, and it's a real-time location of the operator for a standard RID. That's that will have that we, and I know Vic is opposed to this as well. We feel that that is a danger to operators of drones. In addition, an impact will be, we're thrilled, and one of the parts that Josh was working toward was the we were able to get the FAA to eliminate the network requirement of the broadcast for remote ID. That was huge in the sense that that means we did not have to purchase another cell phone subscription in order to fly an FPV drone. And so remote ID is not to be used for DAA, detect and avoid, but it is the first part of the unmanned traffic management. And so we anticipate that the impact of this will be further regulation as UTM comes about. And we also anticipate that network will rear its ugly head again. So so impact to equipment, impact to flight, and for FPV, the FRIAs are a non-starter. And in as much as a FRIA is supposed to be a permanent entity from a legal perspective or an agreement, it doesn't work or doesn't fly, if you'll forgive the pun, for FPV racing either.
Yeah, and I agree with you that the network functionality is not dead in the water. It's coming back. Yeah. The question is it coming back for BV loss flights only, or is it coming back for routine V loss flights, which my preference would be we only need it. I think personally, I read a lot about UTM. I think we only need it for BV loss flights. I don't think it's necessary for local flights. I think it's an additional price that we would have to pay to fly drones. And I've talked about this a lot, saying that the airspace needs to remain free. And once we introduce the network, we need to introduce USS service suppliers. And once we do that, the airspace is no longer free because somebody's going to be charging a fee to get in there. So I think it's a multi-layer. It's a very complex issue. And we'll see what the FAA is going to do. But yeah, that's all I had.
The aspects that's related to that is shielded operations. And so shielded operations, local BV loss is a capability. And shielded operations is a function that we proposed back, and that was our work, back in the UAS facility map DAC. And the FAA has subsequently put forward $232,000 across six schools, colleges, a part of the Assure program, to investigate the validity of shielded operations. So good evidence for us that our work is getting traction, but also part of that, we're using shielded operations as we think this is a good argument for local BV loss, no need for networking for that if it's within a certain radius of operation.
I have a follow-up question for you, Dave. Can you explain to us where remote ID would apply? I mean, if you fly an FPV racing drone inside, or you fly it among trees in a forest, or you fly it in navigable airspace, like how would that potentially be different? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, remote ID, of course, the FAA has no authority indoors, or so they only have authority of the national airspace, and that's still from threads of grass on up into the sky. And so any UAS, small UAS, and that is above 250 grams, and small UAS are then defined as a weight limit of 55 pounds. So in that envelope of half a pound to 55 pounds, you must be registered. You must have, and this is for recreational, you must have a remote ID, and you can put a remote ID, you can retrofit it on an existing hobby-built craft with a module, and there are happily a couple of manufacturers that are involved in the ASTM standard. I'm a member of the F38-3411 working group in the ASTM that's writing a means of compliance to deliver to the FAA. And so I'm aware of, and it's this public knowledge, it's Skydio and DJI and Parrot are on there, as well as the UTM providers, as well as crewed airframe manufacturers. So
and Dave,
those would be the requirements.
Can I stop you for a sec here? Because what you just said is kind of important for a lot of people. There is still a lot of confusion as to why we don't have a remote ID solution. And I think what you're talking about, the committee that you're on with ASTM, is kind of what the industry is waiting for before we can start to submit means of compliance and get the declarations of compliance from the FAA. Is that correct?
It's very close. And so the ASTM has written a remote ID standard that's now going to be updated. And the update, once accepted by the FAA, will be defined as a means of compliance. So from that point forward, if I am a manufacturer, and if I'm Skydio, and I say, okay, I am going to adhere to the ASTM standard amount from 3411 with the 1.1 standard authorization, and that will be an approved means of compliance. That will save, having been someone who's developed an IBM for decades, that'd save about a year's time. Mm-hmm. And so what they then have to work on is, okay, they have to prove to the FAA that they have a declaration of compliance, and it is a design adherence. It is not a field testing. It's not a manufacturing test. It's not an end use test, just a design compliance. So I anticipate that we should be able to have modules as well as standard UAS in time for the 2022, is it, Josh? Required dates of remote ID. September 22 for manufacturers.
September 2023 for pilot operators.
Thank you.
Awesome.
So we've talked about impact. Why do you think remote ID is important for drones?
Well, I think from our perspective, our thoughts are that one size solution doesn't fit all. So I think in a certain aspect, I think for expanded operations like BV line of sight or beyond visual line of sight, it's definitely going to be a requirement, and it's not a bad thing. It allows both you and other people to know where you're flying and know what's going on. It can grant you additional capabilities for something as simple as a recreational flight, whether at a FRIA or in, just out in the world. Our interpretation is it's not the best solution. So notify and fly is probably a better solution for recreational operators, basically saying, I'm flying in this space, I'm going to be here for the next hour, and done and done, as opposed to an arbitrary, need to broadcast your location and what you're doing. I think that there is a heightened awareness of drones, especially in the last couple of years. I think that between some actions that the FAA has taken, some actions that other organizations have taken, as well as media, they have essentially portrayed drones in a pretty bad light. And so I think that fear of the unknown is what's prompting a lot of this, as well as, supposed incidents like Gatwick or, the Las Vegas, where there was a drone that flew around the airport there and power looped like a jet taking off. That kind of stuff go ahead.
If I could build on that. So the FAA has a dual mandate of both security and safety. And so our feeling from a perspective of how important is remote ID for recreational, not important to improve safety. From a perspective of security, we understand that law enforcement wants to be able to see where we are, as well as from a national DHS perspective. And it was DHS who was a very heavy push to the FAA as to putting remote ID in place. And so there's an important aspect here that remote ID, per the FAA, will not be used for detect and avoid. So it's not going to be used for deconfliction. It's not going to be used for authorization. So it's just identification. So from that perspective, probably reasonably important for commercial, and just as Josh was saying, in a beyond visual line of sight mode. But so, yeah, somewhat for security, safety. We don't see that it enhances safety. So not that important for recreational. And so now it's a matter of we try to minimize the impact on the community. How do we get it light, painless, and low cost? Good question.
Do you think people will comply with remote ID, or do you think they're going to find there will be certain users that find a way to skirt the rules or hack the system, I guess you could say?
A reasonable regulation is met with high compliance. Unreasonable regulation is met with low compliance. So remote ID, you know, so if it's 15, if we see broadcast modules that are easily placed on a drone, if they're in the 15-20 gram, so what, 28.3 grams to an ounce, so that's a fair percentage, a material percentage of even a 5-inch FPV quad. But it's 15-20 gram, if it's in that magnitude, if it's, you know, $50, $75, you know, I'd like to see it less. But if it's in that area, then it becomes a so what. However, if we see an increase in the number of operators being accosted as a result of the location of the operator being broadcast, I would assert that there would be a backlash and people will tear the remote ID modules off their aircraft.
And not only that, I think it will kill the project. I mean, the purpose, there is a purpose behind remote ID, as we just discussed, but I think if there's low compliance, then it defeats the purpose. So I want to move away from remote ID. I know it's always a very thick topic, but we got a ton of other topics we want to talk about as well. But I think we've covered quite a bit. I do want to talk about the UAS facility map because, you know, in the grand scheme of UTM, remote ID is one thing, flying beyond visual line of sight is one thing, but LANCE being based on the UAS facility map, for those of you that are not familiar with the UAS facility map, when you go on aloft and you see a bunch of numbers, the grids, that's those grids right here are called UAS facility map. And I know, Dave, you were involved a little bit in some of these plots. Can you tell us a little bit more about this?
This was a highlight of working with the various DAC tasking groups. The tasking group was chaired by Marilyn Mora. She's the CEO of, let me get it right, Reno Tahoe Airport, as well as her executive director worked with me closely on it. I had the privilege of presenting and speaking to the FAA and representing the group. The group that we had was just fantastic, and it defines why a FACA or a Federal Advisory Committee is such a useful entity for an agency. We had air traffic control represented from LAX, from Dallas, from Alaska, and DF and Dallas Fort Worth. We had airframe manufacturers. We had operators. We had people who were managing airports. We had drone manufacturers represented. So the diversity of depth of knowledge was just fantastic. And we came up with a number of very simple recommendations. One was, right now, the grids are about 1 degree by 1 degree, approximately a mile by a mile, and would like to split that so where there was one square, there's four. And it's just the simplicity of that, of if you're you know, in an area that's 1 square mile and you're one little piece of that square overlaps an airport and that's a zero altitude available, then that whole square went to zero. So now we have four, so that chopped it. In addition, we talked a lot about where it makes sense that the FAA should go back and look at these new minimum altitude around in the UAS facility map. How high can I fly if I'm within this grid? And they're going to do that. And one of the things that we asked to pay special attention to was if I'm adjacent to a runway as opposed to off the end of a runway, it should be a very different story. because adjacent to the runway, if I'm flying a crewed aircraft, I'm supposed to be 1,000 feet in the air. So why can't I fly 100 or 200 feet with my drone? So that was accepted by the FAA. And then, as I mentioned, we also put forward the recommendation of, would you please consider shielded operations? And so did that get to some of your points, Greg?
Yes, absolutely. I think the U.S. facility map is much more complex than most people think, and how the numbers become to be the numbers on here is sometimes seems like it's magic, but it's not. There's always a reason behind it, and when you're in a grid that's zero grid, there's a reason why you're in there. And each airport submits their grid, right?
Yes, and that's a key point that I had neglected to mention. Is that in the first blush of the UAS facility map, the numbers were established as quickly as possible, and it was done solely by airport management. Mm-hmm. Subsequent, there's now a stakeholder group that we're asking the FAA to consider people who have a dog in the fight, as they would say. And so there's I have an opinion. Would like to work with you on this from an airport management perspective. So airport management does have a say, air traffic management, ATM has a say, but so do other stakeholders who are operators. So we changed the process in addition to getting them to refine the grids and also adding more airports all the time.
That's outstanding.
So why are there so few professional drone pilots on the DAC?
Well, I would say, ask that question, why is there no representation of recreational drones when recreational drones are by far the largest constituents of drones in the United States? And while Kenji Sugihara and Vic Moss do a great job, they are commercial operators, and they're doing the best they can. It's a reasonable question, and not my place to answer for the FAA. But in having had this conversation with the FAA, I can convey that if you look at the categories of the DAC members, you see manufacturers. Software development, meaning the USS or organizations, the people who will be providing the software for the unmanned traffic management, operators commercial, and then there's an increased emphasis on, are we doing the right things from a society or societal benefit? So you'll see members working there. We have a couple of members, new individual, Dr. Paul Su from the Su Educational Foundation. And so purely aviation education. So they are trying to cover the waterfront from everyone they can think of to get a good representation of the stakeholders. And our position has been, and we've been very vocal about it, that they have failed miserably with respect to recreational, because we had AMA, and they're no longer on, and we had in DJI a strong advocate for recreational, also recreational and commercial, so DJI is no longer on the DAC as well. So we now have no one on the DAC who represents recreational UAS.
Yeah, and that's perhaps a bit of an issue.
Yeah, not that that's a sore point with us.
No, not.
I want to continue talking a little bit about the FAA and drones and safety. I mean, we recently had the FAA Drone Safety Week. I think this was like the third or maybe even the fourth one by now. Drones are, as we all know, the safest form of aviation. But meanwhile, we still have this stigma around us. Like, people kind of fear drones, are afraid of drones. They think bad things are going to happen when people fly drones. When there's a drone over somebody's backyard, somebody must be spying on you. Where does that come from, that fear that people have, the general public, about drones? And what can we as a drone community and drone pilots do to possibly change that?
So in the build-up to the 2018 FAA Reauthorization Act, the FAA was superb in their propaganda that they needed to get a handle on the careless, the clueless, and the criminal. And you know, in Congress, it has to rhyme or be an acronym, and that was so it had good alliteration. So that was the start of it. Josh, you want to pick it up from there? This is a hot topic that you've been spending a lot of time on.
Yeah, it is, and we've had that push from multiple agencies, which is kind of where I was going earlier. But and the media itself has portrayed it that way because a lot of times, bad news sells well. So the funny thing is that the media often portrays drones in an extremely bad light, but they're the first ones that readily adopted drones for commercial use in terms of for shooting segments for their, news channels and whatnot. So it's a pretty interesting dynamic that they've created. So one of the big pushes that we've been on with the FAA is working with them and their social media posts that oftentimes if you're on Facebook or Twitter or anything like that, you'll see them. A lot of times they're very negative posts about drones. And they might be trying to get out a simple message like, hey, there's a TFR in place, over a certain segment of the country due to, POTUS travel or something like that. But, a lot of times they take a very negative spin on it, and it can be taken in a way that creates fear around drones. And so one of the things we've been working with them on is kind of cleaning that kind of stuff up, as well as we were able to work with them this year on the Drone Safety Awareness Week and kind of develop a program or a series of kind of panels where they reached out to recreational operators, and they hosted a panel discussion. One night was on freestyle FPV, one night was on FPV racing, and the next night was on traditional model aviation. And through those, we were able to kind of allow the FAA to learn a little bit about what FPV is, what some of the greater dynamics is in model aviation as a whole, and hopefully take some of that back to their organization and help shape some of their, not only regulations, but their dynamic with the public as well. So,
Of course, we should take this moment to thank Greg and Pilot Institute for being the hosting location for that. So that was sincerely appreciated. And it also brings to light how the FAA operates. If you have an idea, you take it to the FAA, and they generally say, okay, that sounds viable, and we can work with you, but you have to pull it off. And so Josh ran, he's being modest in terms of the organization required to identify the people on the panels, write the questions, do a lot of the back room work, and then the FAA will say, well, it would take us months to get approval for us to put this on. And so, Greg, by you stepping up with Pilot Institute hosting this, we were able to together get this going, get it operational very, very quickly. This was not months and months and months of planning. This was the FAA saying, oh, we have an idea. Are you interested? And so Josh got it done. So did you. And I think it came off rather well.
Yeah, it's like you said, this was a month worth of planning, which for the FAA would have been impossible. But, we all realize, and we have these discussions, Dave, you're in the same meeting that I am every month with the FAA. We do realize that they don't have the means that we have in the outside of the government, and then they don't have the reach that we have. And they know that. So we're happy to help with that. This is our mission. We're an FAA industry partner for a reason, because we want to help spread that information on the FAA safety side of things, which actually brings me to my next question, which is a perfect transition. Let's talk about trust. Trust, the recreational UAS safety test that the FAA released in June of this year. And what are your thoughts on this initiative? Is this something that you think is making a difference? I can tell you we've had, last time I checked was about a couple of weeks ago, we had 30,000 trust certificate just on our website that we had issued. It's probably closer to 35 by now, I'm sure, maybe even more. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, is it making a difference? So we had the privilege of working with the FAA on some of the formation of the administration of this. So we're pulled in, my gosh, it was January of 2020, and had a great, you know, part of a great discussion. So in order to fly an FPV drone today, you have to be pretty skilled. You can purchase, so you can get online and purchase an FPV drone, and you can get going without a lot of knowledge from either radio control or other technologies. But the learning curve is, it's less than it was 5 years ago, but it's still pretty steep. And so the trust is primarily around safety. And that to me is, it's positive from a perspective for a complete newcomer. So we're very supportive on that angle. For the FPV community, if anyone in the FPV community learns something going through the trust, then, you know, we would want to talk to them and, you know, have a little remedial discussion about, you know, you better pay attention a little better because, you know, you're not being safe. And, you need to be a little aware on battery safety, propeller safety, safe flying over people, flying around crowds, you know, it's normal common sense things, flying at a distance, etc. Josh, any additional thoughts on trust?
To kind of wrap that up, I think that, you know, what Dave is getting at is that the entry to FPV is already so high that the amount of learning you get going into the hobby, you learn a lot of that stuff already. I think for the general public, in terms of, you know, the parent who gets their kid a Mavic or, you know, something like that for Christmas, I think that it's going to be more beneficial from there, and hopefully it eliminates some of the accidents that can lead to, you know, further drone regulations or bad press or anything like that. As far as our community as a whole, I think it's become a, I have to have it, so I'm going to do it kind of thing. And luckily they made the barrier for it so low that, you know, it's a 15-minute time investment and a $0 investment. So I think from that aspect, it makes it attainable and easy to get. But as far as, you know, did I learn something that I didn't know before for the FPV community? I would say, that's probably going to be a slim ask. So,
there's an aspect that we think is important. That's a philosophical point, which is the drones that are coming out, particularly the video drones that are coming out, are highly autonomous. And how much training should you be required to take in order to fly that? And so we think it should be different depending on the risk of the operation. And if it's beyond visual line of sight, probably a fair amount of education. But the notion of, well, you know, why should you have any education at all if you're going to fly something that's fully autonomous? That's not where we are parked. We think that you need to understand what's going on, and you need to be able to respond intelligently when something fails. And the whole premise that we're pushing on STEM is we're trying to get young people involved, excited, and when they break it, they can fix it, get back in the air, and then their learning expands, and maybe they get excited and pick up something like a STEM education or STEM-based career. So that's sort of an aside on trust.
We'll talk about STEM in a second.
That the FPV community and the model aviation community at large does a really good job of providing the tools necessary to participate in the hobby. Whether it's, you know, Facebook groups on, you know, asking questions, getting started. A lot of the players in the FPV community have built and created flight simulators that help people get off the ground a lot sooner, that kind of stuff. So, you know, the training within the community, you know, has, you know, always been there, at least since I've been in the hobby. So it's been a pretty cool factor.
Well, we'll get back to STEM and to education in a second. I want to shift gears real quick here. Dave, this one is for you. Gender-neutral language for the FAA's drone team. Can you tell us why this matters, why it's important, and probably also what the kinds of things are that need to change?
Yeah. And so, thanks. Great question. And as I say, I've bought into this 100% now. And so one of the pieces of research that really brought it home to me was done at UT Austin. And they characterized that when we raise our children, we talk to them and we use gender-specific language. And that starts to catalog or category certain activities. And then that becomes a preference. And then that becomes a differentiator. And then that becomes a prejudice. And one of the women who was in a AUVSI panel that I was moderating had an amazing point that also drove this home for me. And she said she does outreach and goes to grade schools, and she brings tiny whoops, little drones with her, and they fly them around the classroom. And in elementary, she has, it's a 50% boys and 50% girls. She does a similar, more advanced discussion, you would hope, with high school students. And she comes back and it's 100% boys and zero girls. And that's the reason why this is so incredibly important. So it has to do with equity and inclusion. And you know, there's a fair amount of eye rolling when people talk about diversity and equity and inclusion. I'm having been a senior manager in IBM for close to four decades, having everyone feel comfortable and, yep, they're participating and they're listened and they have an equal shot is so critically important. And it starts with language. And so one of the things that the FAA has done over the last probably eight, nine, so more on years is they'll do a phrase like his/her. And a lot of the literature and research that we read is that's a cop-out. You need to change and come up with gender-neutral language, the reason being that anything in our English language that creates a disruption in thought. And so his/her, you know, our brain doesn't, you know, stop a hesitation, and you know that's not fluid from our thinking perspective. So it's not good for writing, it's not good for speaking, and it's not good for understanding. And so those, to me, are the elements that there are mechanics in communications that are important, and it's also that it makes one big difference for how we raise our children right up through adulthood. And yeah, it was what a privilege to be part of that group, to provide the research to the writers, and then to watch Michelle Schwartz, an attorney, not a surprise, just present do a great job presenting that in a very coherent and succinct manner.
Language is important, and on that note, how do we make flying drones safer?
Well.
Are they
dangerous?
Are they dangerous to begin with?
Are they
right?
dangerous
no,
today?
I don't think they're dangerous.
We're logging over 10.3 million flight hours a year. We have zero fatalities back at least 5, 6, 7 years. So what is it that we're working on?
Well, no, it's worth repeating. I mean, there still are crashes here and there and people who aren't educated about it.
One of my other hobbies are riding motorcycles. There's a hobby that's really dangerous. And so some of the upsides of, you know, where, you know, as DJI has said, we've saved 750 lives with drones. We have, this blew Josh and me away. We have people come to us, and this started around the response to the remote ID, NPRM, and they say, you know, I'm a PTSD sufferer, and FPV is one of the few things in my life that really pays off, and I can get some relief from my PTSD. We got the same comment from chronic pain sufferers. And they say, you know, when I get up and I have that, I put the goggles on and I'm immersed, it requires so much concentration and I achieve this flow state and the pain is attenuated. And what a magical moment. So how can we make drones safer? I do think that there are environmental considerations around drones as we project forward 8 to 10 years when there are thousands and tens of thousands of drones in the air. And that has to do largely with propeller speed or alternate propulsion methods. You know, so we can make them quieter because certainly not the magnitude of the sound, but the frequency of the sound is, and there are good studies on this too, that makes it an annoyance. To shrouded propellers, certainly that's going to be regulated in, and it already is in a lot of commercial drones. So other than shrouding props, I'm involved in a couple of discussions that are related to minimizing kinetic energy. And so there are aspects of how do you make a drone impart less energy when it crashes. And this is one, to me, it was a comical thing in the DJI FPV drone. So we make all our FPV drones out of carbon fiber frames. They are incredibly durable. It's also very rigid. It also doesn't break very easily. So it will impart a lot of energy. The DJI FPV drone is made of plastic. It breaks when it crashes. When something breaks, just like a crash helmet, it doesn't impart as much energy into the body that it's impacting. So I think there's some good engineering. And I think the UTM, as the skies get more and more crowded, taking on deconfliction is a primary, so both equipment as well as the air traffic system are the ways to make things safer. But we're starting from really, really safe.
Oh, I know. And I'm not saying that it was ever dangerous. And I think it's, the media writes about a few rare crashes and then people, some people seem to think that they aren't. Honestly, when I fly the Mini or Mini 2, I love that propeller cage that snaps right on. And I wish that something like that was available on more models. I think that would make a huge impact.
So opinion. I know for...
Got to get you flying the FPV.
I know. I do. So I do need to get into it.
The Cinewhoops, a lot of them are utilizing the propeller shrouds, especially 3D printed. So... 3D printing has been a massive, great thing for the hobby, and especially those Cinewhoops that do a lot of flying, cinegraphic flying around people and whatnot. Those shrouds definitely make people feel a lot more comfortable. At the same time, for things like racing, where you've got a controlled field and you're not letting people out there, probably not as necessary. So, I would say it depends on the purpose that you're using the drone for, and keep in mind who's going to be around and what, what's going to be done and make the appropriate decision. But I would back Dave up that, flying drones in general is the safest form of aviation that exists since the electric motor has been around, zero fatalities. So, I mean, that's a pretty incredible stat. So,
well, I want to bring up another topic, which is STEM and K-12 and getting the next generation of pilots interested in aviation. And this is a topic that's close to my heart because I believe this is something that we should all be doing. And it's kind of a lifelong goal for me. I got interested in aviation when I was very young because somebody was there to show me aviation and give me that love of flying. What are you guys doing towards this goal? I know you're involved with some groups. Tell us a little bit more about this.
I can start with the work that we're doing with the DAC and some numbers that are just really compelling. And so we are focused on not only, and so we are focused on aviation specific STEM, but that's pilot as well as non-pilot. So if it's technician or whatever that is not being a pilot, that's of interest to us too, because those jobs are critical. And oh, by the way, they're well paid. So one of the numbers that blew me away was the percentage of women in the flight deck and on commercial airlines. And so flight deck, new phrase, gender neutral for, you know, we're not going to use cockpit anymore. So how many women, what's the percentage of women in airlines in the United States? And the number is 3%. So that's appalling. And the woman who was with me on that AUVSI panel was a military pilot. She was also a test pilot for Lockheed, and now she works for Minnesota Department of Transportation. And she made the point that, you know, I'm sorry, women are equal or better pilots. And she had a great point. She said, we're lighter on the sticks. Our duration, our physical duration and mental duration is better than men. So what's the issue? And the issue is, our own bias. And so there is no excuse. We need to do everything we can to encourage girls to get excited about this recreation and this hobby, and young women to get jazzed about, STEM and about activities. So what are we doing? Well, I'm leading a subgroup on the DAC, and what I will be doing is the research to determine the numbers and the proof points. And so I'll be working on what are the opportunity numbers and what's the slice and dice of the numbers, so that as someone comes forward with a point, a premise that they want to make or a hypothesis, they'll be able to say, well, there are n number of kids in grades 9 through 12. And I'll have that number. And so, personally, that's what I'm doing. And then I'll be working on the analysis as well as the recommendations. And so I'm also involved in helping shape what are the recommendations. In addition, we are reaching out to Multi-GP and Flight Test, both of whom have STEM programs. And our personal objective there will be to offer the background that we have on safety, and then lead with safety, common sense, and then also talk about regulations from a perspective of this is what you need to do in order to fly legally. Josh, you want anything to add on that?
I would also say that we've been trying to build some partnerships with a couple different organizations, one being Flight Test, another one being Multi-GP, and their STEM programs that they've been working towards. Flight Test has done a really good job of getting STEM programs rolling in schools, and we'd like to be able to assist them in any way that we can. Multi-GP has been spooling that up as well. So any kind of support that we can lend from one path or another for anybody getting these STEM programs off the ground, we'll definitely, we'll be happy to be involved in. One of our other members, Alex, is currently in college for engineering, and he's heavily involved in a couple different programs, the Global Drone Air Academy, and that he volunteers for, and does a lot of educational work with them. And then he's also involved on the tasking group as well for the K through 12. So, STEM and drones make the perfect analog. They go together flawlessly. So go ahead.
And what we're finding is that as we're doing research, both of in school as well as extracurricular activities involved in STEM and drone related STEM, is that there are probably, we've seen tens, and there are probably hundreds of separate programs. The AOPA has a brilliant program, You Can Fly, and they're now in over 500 high schools, grades 9, 10, 11, 12. And they're working at school by school by school. And I think we're going to have a fantastic set of lessons learned for this DAC program, because I'm reaching out to the Department of Education, and the objective will be, what can we do from a federal level to help, if it's put an imprimatur, a branding, a certification, something on aviation STEM that makes it easier and more, a little less friction to get involved into an individual school board's curricula. And the program that the AOPA has done is they've gone as far as they've created a training for the teachers, and it's continuing education certified, so the teacher can get paid, and then it can drop right into Common Core. And so they've thought through very carefully the curricula for all the course material for 4 years of high school. And that to me is a wonderful thing, and we'll be using that as a learning base as we make recommendations to the FAA.
Yeah, oh, it's amazing. I love it.
Yeah, it's
awesome. I wanted to bring it back to FPV drones. Why are FPV drones so important for young kids to get started in and to learn how to fly those aircraft? And specifically, what do we need to do to get more girls into FPV drone flying?
So you want to take a crack? I'm jotting notes for the answer, Josh. Fine. Did you want?
So I think FPV drones in general are just exciting. They offer a perspective that many don't get to experience unless you're actually, you know, flying an airplane. They give you that bird's eye view. The amount of tricks and techniques that you can learn are amazing. And just being able to control something that does what an FPV drone does, as well as learning all the things that go along with it. Like I was saying, STEM and drones go together perfectly. As you're learning to fly FPV drones, you're learning how, electronics, you're learning the physics behind flight, you're learning how signals are transmitted through the air. There's a lot of things that you need to perfect in order to fly FPV effectively. And then getting out and being able to either race and be competitive. Like team sports, it's a perfect analog for, learning a lot of life lessons, as well as getting out and being artistic through freestyle flight. So it's an expression in several different ways. And for me and a lot of people that I know, it's just exciting. It provides a healthy escape. It's an alternative to video games. It gets you outside. So, I mean, all these things are they're net benefits all around. So, and I think one of the biggest aspects of doing that is getting as many people behind the goggles as possible. And that includes girls and women. And getting them excited young through either a STEM program or through, the hobby aspect like a lot of us are in. And helping them through that process, just like we would help, anybody else in the hobby. And through that, keeping them engaged and, hopefully furthering that along to perhaps a professional drone job for them, or even, manned aviation. So all these are, it's a great thing. And, the more the better. I mean,
so why is it so important? To me, it's their FPV augments sophisticated operations. And so FPV, I think, and from the research that I'm doing, is being added into fully autonomous vehicles. And so one of the guys on the DAC, 40 years experience as a helicopter pilot, said, when I'm in a helicopter, I like to know where I am and I look around. And that sounds like such a common sense thing. Well, you look out the window. Oh. So if you're doing some sophisticated, fully autonomous, and you're doing an inspection of a railroad and you're doing 150 miles a day, would you like to know if you're over here or over here? Maybe you're not over the tracks. So it's augmenting very sophisticated operations. Another was that there's a piece of research where some students are using artificial intelligence to locate the drone. They're using FPV as a check. So it's critically important. Then from why is it important to kids? One of the stumbling blocks in learning to fly a radio control model is as the model is flying away from you, right is right, up is up, left is left. As it comes back to you, up is up, left is right, and right is left. So that's and the throttle is still the same. It's still up is up. So that's traumatic, and it takes a lot of training. And one of the people or the group of people that we have the most difficult teaching radio control model airplanes are crewed aircraft pilots, people like Rick, because they have such a muscle memory. They have years and years and years of how to, you know, so when the plane is flying away from them, they're incredible and it's just beautiful. And then it comes back to them and it's like, you know, it's just crash and burn. So that allows a much faster speed to success. And so for kids, it's critically important. You put the goggles on and it's intuitive because they've been playing with joysticks for a while. And as the multi-GP guys say, FPV racing is a great antidote to video games. So you put them on the sticks, they know what they're doing, and it's, you know, it's very intuitive. How to get girls excited. Some of the best, so it's a catchphrase, but I buy into it, and that's see it, be it. And so if a girl can see a woman who's successful in a career, then that tells the girl, okay, this is possible for me. This is not, you know, this is not something I'm excluded from. And so any chance we can to reinforce see it, be it, we do. So to circle back to Josh's point about the why is it important? It's the immersion of when you put the goggles on. And it's, to me, it's very different. You know, we all have drones with tablets or using on a phone. It is a completely different experience when you put on a set of goggles and you're moving quickly. And you're moving quickly, like 60, 70 miles an hour, close to a surface. The excitement, the adrenaline is there. And it's compelling. And it also allows us to do a lot of things that cannot be done any other way. And it's outside of filming. It's whether it's search and rescue or other serious jobs. It's important, and it's also a tremendous amount of fun. And it's much safer than riding a motorcycle at 70 or 80 miles an hour.
So I haven't seen a woman's FPV coalition out there. Is there one I should be aware of?
Not to my knowledge. There are. Right. We are. If there's anyone doing what we are in recreational, I'd like to know about them in any capacity. Yeah. I think we are the only 501c3 actively working with the FAA on regulations. And so Josh Bixler has started the FTCA, the Flight Test Community Alliance, and we're talking to Josh, but they are not as nearly as active as we are with the FAA. There's Pennsylvania Drone Alliance. That's a trade association, so it's a 501c6, not a 501c3, so they will not be a CVO. Pardon me for all the abbreviations. There are a couple of organizations that Vic and Kenji have introduced us to, but nothing that is specific to girls or young women in or women in recreational. So we're
interesting.
One of the areas where there's breakthrough is racing, and we are very excited about that. One of the things, there are a lot of FPV moms, and so that's not a derogatory statement at all. No, what's happening is moms are like, you know, soccer mom. My wife was a soccer mom for 14 years. moms are bringing their daughters to to get involved in FPV racing, and that's fantastic. And so there was a large number of girls and young women at the national multi-GP event this year called I.O. out in Muncie. So that's an area that to me is it should be at Muncie, Indiana, should be an area of focus.
Indiana. I was just going to say Muncie's in Indiana. I'm in Michigan. So that is sort of close. Close enough.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good event.
Yeah. Sounds like it.
All right. As we get close to the end of the show, I always have a question for our guest, and we have two guests today. So I have the same question for both of you. What is your favorite thing to fly? And I didn't say drone because I know some of you fly fixed wing, which I wouldn't consider a drone. So what's your favorite thing to fly?
I know mine is a so I have to pick from many radio control model airplanes powered by nitro fuel as well as electric, as well as I think it's 19 drones at last count. My favorite is any one of my DJI FPV system powered drones. The graphics and the and so this is the DJI graphics with frames that I assembled, and so they're still fast and they're agile, and the video is just unbelievable. And so that's my any one of the three or four that I have powered with DJI graphics.
So my favorite one, my favorite model to fly is actually one that I designed. Yeah, it's up here on the wall. Let me grab that real quick. So this is one that I learned how to do Fusion 360 on. So I designed this while I was learning Fusion 360. I call it a Wraith. It's a very compressed central frame. It's got some unnecessary flourishes with these pinchers out here. But it's very organic, and this thing takes a beating. I've probably crashed this 50 times, and the only thing I've ever broken was one arm. So probably my favorite thing to fly. I swap out motors and flight controllers on it often. So you know, it gets refreshed from time to time, but the frame itself is definitely is agile and durable. So I love to fly that.
That's outstanding. And Ohio, you've got the final word. It's all yours. Oh, you're muted. Oh no, wait.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Yeah, there you go. You're good.
All right. So this brings us to the end of this Pixel Drone Show. Dave, Josh, thank you so much for being on the show. It was super interesting to talk with both of you. I think it also now is on record as the longest Pixel Drone Show we've had in our 1 year being here on YouTube and on podcast platforms. For anybody who is interested in the FPV Freedom Coalition, please be sure to check out their website. It's fpvfc.org, and you'll find all the information as well as Josh's and Dave's contact info on the website. So please be sure to go there and consider either joining or being a member. Also, please consider sharing the Pixel Drone Show with your friends and family. I mean, like I said at the beginning, the more people watch us, the faster we'll grow, and the more we can educate people about flying drones safely and responsibly, and also get you all the cool stories from people from the drone industry. That pretty much wraps it up for us this week. Thank you so much for listening and perhaps watching on YouTube. We'll be back with another episode next Tuesday.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There you go.